Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Ardell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Vinlong. Chapter 21, A Doubtful Exchange. It was the Monday morning, after the flight of Tomlinson, when Ingleby stood beside a pile of debris on the claim which was no longer his. The rain had stopped, and there was a wonderful freshness in the mountain air. Overhead, the mists were streaming athwart the forest, pierced by arrows of golden light. And the fragrance of redwood and cedar filled the hollow. It is a scent that brings sound rest to the jaded body when night closes down and braces it as an elixir in the coolness of the dawn. Ingleby drank it in with vague appreciation. There was hope in it, and vigor, and as he stood with the torn blue shirt falling apart from his bronze neck, looking out on the forest with steady eyes, there was something in his attitude which suggested the silent, hasteless strength of the wilderness. The impulsiveness which had afflicted him in England had gone, and steadfastness had grown in its place. The crude, half-formed thoughts and theories which had worked like yeast in him had ceased their ebullition, purging themselves perhaps by the froth of speech, and had left him with a vague optimism, too deep for articulate expression. Faith he had always had, and now, the half-comprehending hope that looks beyond all formulas, had also come. So much, at least, the wilderness had done for him. He laughed as he turned toward Sewell and Ledger, who sat on the pile of thrown-up gravel behind him. "I've been standing here almost 5 minutes doing nothing." "I don't know why," he said. "One does not, as a rule, get rich that way in this country." Ledger grinned at him. "You have just finished a remarkably good breakfast, for one thing," he said. "Still, haven't you made an admission? You always knew why you did everything in England." Ingleby smiled good-humoredly. "Well," he said, "I'm seldom quite so sure now. Perhaps it's because I'm older. Or it may be the fault of the country. Floods and frosts, slides of gravel, and blue-grit boulders are apt to upset the results one feels reasonably certain of here." "That recalls the fact that I broke out a quantity of promising-looking dirt the last time I went down this shaft and didn't try the color." "You have sunk several shafts now, and you're evidently improving," said Sewell. "The original one wasn't sunk or driven, it was scratched out anyhow." "3 or 4, and I've made some $200 out of the lot of them. In fact, I've been spending my labor profitlessly ever since I came into the country. That is, at least, so far as one can see." Sewell smiled. "There's a good deal in the reservation. The whole country's full of just such holes, from Caribou to Kootenay. A few men took gold out of them. The rest put something in." "Buried hopes," said Ledger with a grin. "Probably," answered Sewell. "Now and then, buried men. Still, the ranches and the orchards came up after them. It was presumably good for somebody, although a little rough on the prospectors in question." Ledger appeared reflective. "I wonder if anyone could grow plums and apples on Captain Esmond. In the language of the country, it's about the only use it could have for him. Well, I've smoked my pipe out. Are we going to stay here and maunder any longer, Ingleby?" "I'm going down the mine, though, as it doesn't belong to me now. I don't know why. Still, it's close on bottom, and I'd like to try the color of the dirt I broke out on Saturday." He went down the notched pole and filled the bucket Sewell lowered after him, and when the latter hove it up, they proceeded to the creek and the other sat down while Ingleby washed out its contents. Neither of them showed any particular interest in what he was doing. They had been some time in the gold-bearing region now, and had discovered that it is generally wise to expect very little. Then Ingleby scrambled up the bank, with a curious look in his face, and gravely held out the pan. "Placer mining is a tolerably uncertain thing, but here's a result I never anticipated 2 or 3 days ago," he said. "Look at this." They bent over the pan, and their faces grew intent at the sight of the little grains of metal in its bottom. Then Ledger looked up with a gasp. "You struck it again," he said, "apparently as rich as ever." Ingleby stood still a moment, gazing straight in front of him with vacant eyes, and one hand closed a trifle at his side. "Yes," he said harshly, "the second time, and once more it's of no use to me. When I recorded as part owner of Tomlinson's claim, this one fell into the crown. You're on the lead, Tom, and you'll strike it too, but you can get your stakes in, Sewell. Sunday's an off day, or the major would have had his notice out by now." It was a relief to do anything just then, and he cut and drove in 2 of the location pegs the law required. Then when the last was driven, he turned to Sewell with grim quietness. "Well," he said, "why don't you get away and make your record? There's no reason you should throw away a fortune, too." Sewell smiled a little. "One thing, Major Colthurst would certainly not be up when I reached his office. For another, before I record the claim, there's something to be said. The law, you see, cannot be expected to cover every contingency, and if you look at it from one point of view, the claim is still yours. I'll buy the goodwill of you if you'll take my bill." Ingleby shook his head impatiently. "I can't sell you what isn't mine," he answered. "Anybody who thinks it worthwhile can record that claim. It belongs to the crown. I have my share and Tomlinson's mine, and in one respect, I'm not sorry to see this one come into your possession. You at least would not consider the gold you took out belonged to yourself." Sewell looked at him with an expression in his face, which somewhat puzzled Ledger. "No," he said, "it's not wise to be too sure of anything, Ingleby." "I believe you told us you had struck gold once before. What did you do with it? When we met you in Vancouver, you hadn't the appearance of a man who has a balance at his bank." A suggestion of darker color crept up into Sewell's face. "You can't carry on a campaign of any kind without funds. The last one I embarked upon not long before you came across me was too big for us. It broke the exchequer and landed me in jail." "Precisely," said Ingleby. "And what title have I to the money you would hold in trust? That is the difference between us. I'm not a leader. I'm glad of it just now. And what gold I find, I want for myself." Once more, Sewell's expression furnished Ledger with food for reflection, though Ingleby did not appear to notice it. It is now and then a trifle embarrassing to have one's good deeds proclaimed to one's face, and Ledger was aware that all Sewell gained was usually expended on the extension of his propaganda. But that did not seem to account for everything, and he fancied the man had winced at his comrade's speech as though it had hurt him. Then Sewell made a curious little gesture. "It is," he said, "seldom worthwhile to decide what other people will do. They don't know themselves very frequently. Well, since nobody ever persuaded you, I'll get on and record the claim." He left them, and neither Ingleby nor Ledger broke the silence as they pushed on up the valley near the farther end of which Tomlinson's claim lay. Ledger knew that because his claim adjoined the one his comrade had allowed to fall to the crown, he too would in all probability find gold, and since now it would be all his, that fact alone was sufficient to occupy him. Still, he was getting accustomed to the dramatic unexpectedness of the results of placer mining, and he was also sensible of a certain sympathy for Ingleby, who held no more then a third share in Tomlinson's mine. Then he recalled Sewell's face and wondered again. The man had certainly appeared embarrassed, and that had its significance in connection with what Ingleby had said. Sewell was certainly entitled to use what gold he dug toilfully from the earth, as seemed best to him, and there was no reason why he should devote it to the liberation or enlightenment of those he might regard oppressed, unless he wished. That he had done so hitherto was, it seemed to Ledger, plain, but he fancied it was to be different now. This led to the question, what did Sewell, who lived with Spartan simplicity, want the gold for? And to that there was no answer until he changed the what to whom. Then a reason suggested itself, for Sewell of late had played chess with Major Colthurst frequently, more often indeed, Ledger fancied, than Ingleby knew. It was a relief to both of them when they reached Tomlinson's mine, which was by no means imposing at first sight, consisting as it did of a little gap in the forest, strewn with blackened branches and charred fir stumps, a shanty, a pile of shattered rock and gravel, and a black hole with a very rude windlass straddling it. It did not count at all that it was engirdled by towering trees, whose somber spires, lifted one beyond the other in climbing ranks, led the wondering vision upwards ever across the face of a tremendous crag, where they clung dotted against the gray rock and the fissures to the ethereal gleam of never-melting snow. It was sufficient that the clink of the shovel and clatter of flung-up gravel came out of the scented shadow, in token that Tomlinson's claim was on the lead, the bed which had been worn out and left ages ago by the Green River or some other which had washed away the matrix rock. Ingleby stopped beside the windlass and rolled the sleeves of his blue shirt to the elbow as he looked into the shadow beneath him. Exactly what is down there, I don't know. And it seems a little astonishing now that I didn't ask Tomlinson when I bought the mine, he said. There should be $1,000 anyway. Tom, are you going to stand shares with me? Ledger looked at the shaft, and for no very apparent reason became sensible of unpleasant misgivings. No, he said, you hold only a third share anyway, and I'm not sure that if you split it up there would be enough for two. Still, I'll stay with you until this evening. You should have some notion how the thing will work out by then. They went down and toiled steadily for several hours in the short heading Tomlinson had driven. Then Ledger ascended and hove up the bucket Ingleby filled, after which they transported the debris to the rocker at the adjacent creek. Tomlinson's flume, which would bring the water to the mine, was not finished yet. By the time this was done, the dinner hour had come, and Ledger looked at Ingleby as he took up his axe. Would you like to go on? He asked. No, said Ingleby with a little harsh laugh. There was a time when if I'd had no food since yesterday, I should not have stopped, but one gets over that. Besides, I almost fancy we shall know quite soon enough what a third share in the Tomlinson mine is worth. Ledger made a fire, and Sewell appeared while they ate. I've made the record. How have you got on? He inquired. Ingleby pointed to the pile of soil and stones and sand. So far, we're not going any farther until after dinner. It is not very long since I turned prospector, but I have twice bottomed on gold and had to let it go. The last occasion was only 2 or 3 hours ago, and I'm not quite sure I've got over it yet. Sewell nodded sympathetically. There is gold here, though it's remarkable that nobody seems to know how much, he said. Tomlinson apparently was not communicative. That, said Ingleby, is of course the question. If there is not a good deal, a third share is scarcely likely to recompense me for leaving the other claim, especially when there is $1,000 to come out of this one. There's one reason I'm getting dinner. Before I go any further, I bought a pig and a poke, you see, and now I'm almost afraid to open it. I wonder why you made the bargain, especially in view of the fact that Tomlinson told you the chances of striking gold on your own claim were good. Ingleby appeared a trifle confused. Well, he said Tomlinson had found gold while I hadn't then, and one naturally prefers a certainty. The man was in a difficulty, too. Tomlinson, in fact, made use of the old woman back in Oregon, somewhat artistically. Ingleby flushed a trifle. He was one who, though he had formerly at least proclaimed his views, nervously concealed his charities. Tomlinson never meant to wrong me of a dollar. He isn't that kind of a man, he said. No, said Sewell with a little laugh. I scarcely think he did. Well, are we to help you with the wash-up? They toiled for a while, knee-deep in very cold water, while the rocker clashed and rattled, and Ingleby, whose face grew a trifle grim as the time wore on, washed out the residue of its contents in a little pan. Then, for the others insisted, when there was a good deal of the pile left, they went back to the mine, and the hour of supper had crept round again when Ingleby came out of the stream, carrying the result of all that they had done in a little pan. He stood still a moment in the shadow of the pines, and his lips were set and his eyes unusually grave as he looked at Sewell. If your new claim turns out dirt equal to what we found this morning, you will go south rich, he said. I would sooner you had it than anybody else, and I don't think I grudge it you. Sewell took the pan from him and glanced into it. I'm sorry, he said simply. The thing is done now, and I can't make you a partner unless you let Tomlinson's claim go, which I presume you don't mean to do. That is, of course, quite out of the question. Tomlinson went out believing it was safe with me. Then we come back to the other suggestion. I still fancy you are entitled to sell me what one might consider your option on the claim. There are men in the valley who would have willingly handed you their bill for $1,000 for the information you supplied me. Ingleby looked at him steadily with his head held back a little. It already belonged to the crown, he said. Have I ever done anything that would lead my friends to believe they could bestow alms on me? Sewell smiled. I fancy there are one or two of them who advocate a community of property. It occurred to Ledger that it might be advisable to change the subject. I'm afraid we usually stop there, he said with a grin. It has seemed to me lately that there are two difficulties in the way of bringing an equitable division about, though most people only recognize the obvious one, which is, however, serious enough. I mean, inducing the people who have anything worth having to part with it. The other? The other, said Ledger reflectively, would consist in inducing the people who have very little to receive it. There are a few of them who wouldn't be willing to do so, at least in the colonies. They want to reap only what they have sown. It isn't quite clear that they will be permitted. Ledger smiled dryly, though he looked hard at Sewell. Well, he said, I almost fancy one could leave it to them. It would be an unfortunate thing for the men who insist on getting in the way of the sickle. Then he turned to Ingleby and laid a hand on his shoulder. It might be worse, he said. Yes, answered Ingleby, who laughed a little, though it cost him an effort, considerably. The man who has what is evidently a very good living in his hands really doesn't deserve very much sympathy. Still, you see, I twice threw away what looked like a fortune. Anyone would find the reflection apt to worry him. They went away and left him sitting on a blackened cedar stump in the desolate clearing. The clink of the shovels no longer rose from beyond the somber trees, and there was a deep stillness in the hollow. The gaps in the forest grew duskier, and a peak across the valley flung a cold blue shadow athwart the gleaming snow. The dew was settling heavily, but Ingleby sat still, grave in face, seeing nothing, until he rose with a little resolute shake of his shoulders and, slipping down from the stump, took up his axe. He had twice thrown away a fortune, and with it, for a time at least, the prospect of realizing a very precious hope. But fortunes are now and then retrieved suddenly in that country. And in any case, a man who would work must eat. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaw.